From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Bo Dien, correspondent for The Times of London, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong and Moscow. The trade war between the United States and China rolls on. President Trump steps up his efforts to curb immigration and also pressures Israel to keep two American congresswomen from visiting that country. Well, let's start with these protests in Hong Kong and Moscow. First in Hong Kong, the big international airport there has resumed normal operations after riot police came in. They clashed with these pro-democracy protesters who pretty much took over the airport for a couple of days. They cleared them out forcibly. These protesters used luggage carts as barricades to keep people from entering. Just a real mess here. What is going on there now, and what's sort of the larger agenda of these protesters?
Yeah, it was a stunning 2 days at Hong Kong International Airport where, Paul, as you mentioned, over 200 flights were shut down. There was police riots, scenes of chaos, but also some really sort of heart-rending scenes early on before the protests turned violent of pro-democracy demonstrators sitting, singing, can you hear the people sing from Les Miserables, sort of demanding several things that grew out of what was initially a demand to withdraw an extradition bill back in June into what have become huge protests to demand more rights for Hong Kongers, demand the ousting of Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive, and just as a lot of anger and frustration with what's been seen as overreach from Beijing has really put pressure on Hong Kongers who want more rights, more democracy, more say in where they live. The issue is far from over, really coming to a head again, perhaps, over the weekend as more protests are planned this Sunday and as Beijing steps up its pressure on the island, building up the military police presence across the channel in Shenzhen. The Chinese ambassador to Britain, Liu Xiaoming, saying in London yesterday, you know, Beijing won't sit on its hands as Hong Kong goes down this road. It's quite a volatile and scary situation as we await what the response from Beijing might be.
Well, let me ask you this. When Britain gave up control to China of Hong Kong, I think back in 1997, everybody was told that it would be one country, two systems. Is Beijing honoring that? It seems like over the last few years, it's sort of like chipping away at that guarantee. We know that people who have bookshops, for example, have just disappeared. Opposition leaders, journalists have just kind of vanished. So to what degree are they honoring this so-called one country, two systems pledge?
I think that's exactly the right point to make because this extradition bill earlier in the summer sort of was the initial impetus for the protests was exactly seen as one of these moves that Beijing is doing to chip away at that one country, two systems idea, the idea that Hong Kongers would have a level of autonomy and say in their own governance. And I think as time goes on, you can understand why those tensions are coming more and more to a head because there's a 50-year period before Hong Kong reverts totally back to Chinese rule under the terms of the handover and what that means for the quote-unquote one country, two systems system is really going to come under pressure as that time goes on.
And this is something that's sort of come out in some of the interviews you hear with the protesters, this awareness of this looming deadline. You know, their parents may have accepted this 50-year time period, but for a lot of these young protesters, that handover to complete control by the Chinese government will happen in their lifetimes. And so they are out there sort of making this argument that this is our kind of last chance to stop this progression or to claim what rights we can make.
Now, Kimberly, one other question for you. You are a financial journalist. Hong Kong, of course, is a major financial center in Asia. a city known for its freewheeling enterprise, entrepreneurialism.
Much
all
more
that.
Of a capitalist economy.
Is that in jeopardy?
For the time being, it's definitely on hold a bit because the protests have sort of gummed up the mechanics of the operations of the cities. Boer was mentioning the airport, but also lots of people not showing up to work. And so the actual operation of businesses is definitely slowing down. But you haven't seen sort of a large-scale effort by some of these multinational companies that have headquarters in Hong Kong to sort of say, oh, we can't operate here anymore, because it is still sort of the best bet for many of these companies in that part of the world.
Just to add on to what Kimberly was saying, though, there is a great awareness from everyone of how important the Hong Kong Financial Center is. And in fact, one of the places that the protesters have been discussing staging protests is in the stock exchange. So it's not like anyone is saying we're not going to operate out of Hong Kong, but at the same time, the vulnerability and the recognition of the place as a financial center does make it quite a volatile situation.
Now, moving on, big protests in Russia as well. They've been going on in Moscow for quite some time now, several weekends in a row against the rule of Vladimir Putin, who more or less has ruled Russia with, fair to say, an increasingly iron fist since 1999. The Russian economy has stagnated. Living standards are dropping. People are fed up with corruption. Where, in your view, is all this going, Kimberly?
Well, I mean, this is sort of the latest step by the Putin government to sort of block opposition candidates from what were, you know, sort of low-level local elections. But many of these candidates were just sort of, their positions on the ballots were invalidated, signatures were invalidated, and that's what initially spawned these protests. Some things that were happening at a very local level to sort of keep anti-Putin local leaders out, but then it has sort of grown over the weeks to sort of a larger statement against the lack of democracy, the lack of freedom, and the lack of real opportunity for opposition in the country. And that is something that's been bubbling under the surface for quite some time. The Russian government has been pretty effective at arresting and detaining and suppressing opposition leaders. I mean, we're seeing more of that in these protests, and so it seems like more of the same, that crackdown.
Yeah, and I suspect that we'll only see more of these movements going forward. I mean, 60,000 people in Moscow over the weekend, the last weekend, you know, the largest demonstrations since 2012. And even though President Putin will be in office until 2024, there is a big Duma election in 2021, which is not that far off. You know, if you think about the US election, which is in 2020, and people have already started campaigning, you can understand why, despite the fact that we're still 2 years away, it may not seem like it's that far away, especially given, as Kimberly was mentioning, the low levels of protests that have been happening on local levels.
The Duma, for people who might not know, is the lower chamber of the Russian parliament. The other question for you, Kimberly, is, you know, the Russian economy, so heavily dependent upon oil, it's really the principal export that they have, and yet the oil prices have really been falling rather sharply over the past couple of weeks, couple of months. They're so heavily dependent on oil revenue. To what degree is that kind of undercutting the Russian economy? I know that living standards have been dropping for some time. Wages are not going up. I mean, tell me about that.
The Russian economy is indeed sort of at the macro level very dependent on oil. I don't think you're seeing that show up in people's regular day-to-day lives just yet because oil markets fluctuate so much. But the fact that oil prices have been sort of struggling globally has definitely influenced how Russia has been intervening in some of these other conflicts around the world, particularly things that are happening in Iran, things that are happening in Yemen and all over. And so you are seeing that ripple through, and also in the relationship with the United States. Our fracking and the oil that we produce from fracking has really shifted the nature of the market. And you're seeing OPEC nations, members of the sort of oil producing cartel, really start to kind of scramble to forge new alliances and work out new ways of interacting with each other in light of the glut of oil coming out of the United States.
That's really one of the huge developments sort of geostrategically over the last, say, 15 years or so, is this huge shale revolution in the United States. It's almost like the OPEC's strength has been almost broken because of that, and the United States is much less dependent now upon foreign oil than ever before. But let's move on quickly to, we're talking about China and economics a couple of minutes ago. The U.S. is postponing this new 10% tariff on Chinese manufactured consumer products. President Trump made this concession, apparently unilaterally, did not ask for anything in return. He says it's necessary to help American consumers during the upcoming Christmas shopping season. My question for you, Bohr, is quickly here. If China is paying for these tariffs, as the president claims, why does he need to give American consumers a break by delaying them?
I remember the last time we all sat together, we talked a bit about tariffs as well. And the president has sort of gone back. It's quite fascinating watching the Trump administration going from one minute tying the tariffs to one concession or another, and then the next minute not doing so. Is laser focused on, as we talked about, his 2020 reelection. And I think he's quite concerned, Paul, as you mentioned, about consumers in the upcoming Christmas shopping season having a hit with prices going up if the strength of the dollar goes up, given the turmoil going on in China. If there is a crash in China, we'll see a rising dollar. American exporters will be harmed. Consumer confidence.
But again, if China pays for these tariffs, why does he have a need to help American consumers out?
Because as every economist will tell you, and politicians who are being honest, tariffs are paid by the end users. The tariffs that have been put in place thus far, the tariffs that were going to be put in place, those were being paid for by American companies and eventually American consumers. And so it wasn't true. The president, and this is what made this week particularly interesting, because it was one of the first times that we've heard the president of the United States acknowledge that consumers are feeling the pain of this tariff, even though he's said the opposite leading up to this. And so this delay is not only for those consumers, but also for the businesses who were going nuts over this, and also for the markets, because several of the major investment houses were saying this is pushing us closer to a recession.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to, just the acknowledgement from the president that tariffs are paid ultimately by the American consumer. He just has never admitted that, but it was a tacit admission.
He said the opposite, which is not true.
Tacit admission of that in the past couple of days. Well, let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Bohr Dien, correspondent for The Times of London, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. The Trump administration is rolling out a new policy it says will stop immigrants already in the United States from obtaining permanent residency or citizenship if they use public benefits such as Medicaid, food stamps, or housing assistance. This, of course, is part of the White House's broader campaign to curb immigration, even legal immigration, which they've said they want to cut down on. Kimberly, you know, the president says that immigrants who come to this country get these sorts of public benefits, and it's a huge drain on the American taxpayer. But the fact is, even undocumented immigrants pay billions of dollars in taxes. That is what the data shows. So what is the president talking about here?
Well, the president is pushing an agenda that he's been quite clear about laying out from the start of his administration. Anything that can be done to reduce the number of immigrants coming into the country, legal or otherwise. And so in this case, what the administration is talking about is something called a public charge. A public charge is somebody who uses government benefits. So if you are a single low-income mother living in the United States who needs food benefits to help you get milk and dairy products to your children, we have a program called WIC that would make you a public charge. And so the Trump administration has been talking about this for some time. This will take effect in October. That basically means if you are an immigrant, legal or otherwise, and you start taking advantage of public benefits, it's a strike against you when you are applying for legalization and naturalization. But in terms of these numbers that you're discussing, yes, if you are here as an immigrant, legally or no, you're paying sales taxes. If you're getting some kind of income, even if it's under the table, your employer is probably paying into some tax system for you, and you're just not necessarily able to get those benefits like Social Security. But this particular rule is likely to make people less likely to want to take advantage of those benefits, and that actually has states worried, because if you look at something like Medicaid, which is a health program for low-income people in the United States, states get money for their Medicaid programs based on how many people are using it and registered to use it. And when, if all of these immigrants stop using it because they're afraid they won't be able to be naturalized as a result, it means less money for the states to maintain these programs, which they need for American citizens as well.
In the meantime, what happens to these low-income mothers who, for example, need formula and diapers for their children if they kind of disappear into the shadows because they're afraid? I mean, what happens to them?
A lot of advocacy groups are very worried that people worried about risks to their immigration status as a result of this public charge rule will just not reach out for food assistance, for health assistance, which will lead to potentially more poverty, potentially malnutrition, and other negative consequences of people not being able to use the social safety net out of fear.
And also additional costs downstream when those new problems are...
Right. If somebody's not getting preventative health care that they would otherwise get under, say, Medicaid, then the first time you see them is when they show up to the emergency room, but then they can't pay their bill because they are low income, and then that gets absorbed into the system, and that's a cost that's paid by everyone.
So people are going to pay one way or another, it would seem. Now, Bor, you know, this broader issue of how the U.S. economy has always benefited from immigration, I mean, going all the way back to the founding of this country, we've always relied on newcomers to bring in, you know, new energy and new ideas to the table. They create businesses at a faster rate than native-born Americans, for example. These seem like good things, and yet the clampdown on them, what's sort of the broader effect of this, the clampdown on people coming into this country from an economic standpoint?
Yeah, I think one thing that Kimberly mentioned, that the administration has always sort of tried to crack down on immigration, legal or illegal. And this policy really sort of highlights that for conservatives and supporters of the administration who say, oh, we're not worried about legal immigration, we just want to keep people who are here without papers out. This sort of clearly shows the false premise of that claim, because this will affect people who are here legally. And if you're not a citizen, if you're even a green card holder, instills a lot of fear in what are you actually able to get from the state? What are your actual rights? And I think from a sort of economic standpoint, I think the goal of the administration has always been to change the profile of who gets to come to this country. The difficulty is that people who are targeted by this rule are people who work in very important industries in this country, in agriculture, in sort of processing, in these kinds of fields where we can't really find educated workers to fill those jobs.
And or even people with low education. This has been a common complaint from the agriculture mm-hmm. sector, from the hospitality industry, from home health care, where they need people to care for our aging population. There are not enough workers in the United States, or at least this is the claim, to do these low-wage jobs, or at least the people who could do them are choosing not to for a variety of reasons. There was an immigration raid at a chicken processing plant in Mississippi, and they immediately had to have a job fair.
Exactly.
Where not enough people even showed up to the job fair to replace all of the workers they lost in that raid.
And to Kimberly's point, one of the issues that came up in that was a lot of people who could actually qualify for those jobs decided not to show up because of fear over what their actual status and actual rights.
There's always been this point, ladies, from people who oppose immigration. They say they look at it from kind of a jobs standpoint. Well, they're stealing our jobs. But you just mentioned jobs that a lot of Americans, for example, don't want to do. They don't want to change sheets in hotel rooms or pick strawberries in the field and so forth. We need people to do these things.
So I should clarify, many American workers don't want to do those jobs at the wages that they are being paid and the benefits that are being offered. So the counter argument to it, although your point is valid, is that if these industries paid more, if they offered better benefits, then you would get American workers to do them. But that then drives up your prices for your strawberries, your hotel room, your chicken that you buy that's been processed. All of these things drive up prices. And so there's this counterbalance. True, American citizens don't want to do these low-wage, high labor-intense jobs. But the other hand, if they were not so low-wage, perhaps they would do them. But that's a big economic cycle.
And more quickly here, you are always saying that the president has this laser focus on his 2020 reelection, this fight against immigrants. That's totally what this is about, it seems to me. It plays well with his base. They have this, in general, this bias sort of against people coming into this country. Is that what this is all about for him?
I think so, because his initial promise when he first ran for president was that he was going to build a vast wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's clearly run into a lot of problems. His other promise initially, if we remember back to 2016, to keep out people who were Muslim with a anti-Muslim travel ban, that clearly was ruled as unlawful. So he's got to get something to happen in the time between now and November 2020 that he can come to the table to his supporters and say, look, I, you know, may not have gotten the exact thing that I promised, but my stance of benefiting the American worker, keeping out people who are undesirable, that's a promise that I've fulfilled. And as these sort of other specific promises have stalled or not worked out for him, he's sort of looking for other ways to get that done.
Now, we've got just a couple of minutes left here, and one other issue here, speaking of President Trump, is he wants Israel, our close ally in the Middle East, to bar two members of Congress from visiting that country. We're talking about Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib. Trump says it would be a great sign of weakness for his good friend Benjamin Netanyahu to allow these women into his country. Trump dislikes them because they've been deeply critical of him and his policies. And I think we've now learned that Tlaib will be allowed in, but she's now saying, well, no, thanks. I don't want to go after all. Kimberly, your thoughts on this?
President Trump tweeted that it would be a sign of weakness for Israel to allow them in. Israel then banned them, received a ton of pushback here in the United States, including from some major pro-Israel groups, which has said it was a bad look for Israel that they couldn't allow foreign leaders to come in and that it showed weakness on behalf of Israel. So then Rashida Tlaib submitted her application again, asking to go in on humanitarian grounds to see her 90-year-old grandmother, promised not to get engaged with her boycott, divest movement while she was in the West Bank. Israel said, okay, you can come in. And now we're seeing news that she's still declined after receiving a lot of pushback from her supporters. It's quite a complicated story, but we'll see if they decide to go.
Now, Kimberly made a good point, Boer, that Israel is an open democracy where people argue all day long about every issue under the sun. That's what you do in a democracy. So to bar members of the United States Congress from visiting would certainly be inconsistent with what they claim to be.
Yeah, and exactly as Kimberly said, it's a bad look for what is supposed to be a vibrant democracy. The point is that these two congresswomen, they're the first two Muslim American women to be in Congress. They have each gotten into a bit of trouble in the U.S. because they've been very outspoken sort of advocates of their views that there should be a boycott and divestment and sanctions movement against the Israeli government, which they say has been unfair to Palestinians.
Does it not seem that the true sign of weakness is in fearing free speech by someone that you happen to disagree with?
If you accept the premise that this was done out of fear as opposed to sort of a political calculation, one of the criticisms of Benjamin Netanyahu is that he is appearing to be using his own authority in Israel to advance the political goals of someone in the United States, President Trump, whether or not that was actually a good move for Israel. In terms of freedom of speech in Israel and the occupied territories, I mean, you could go on all day about how much freedom there is and for who to speak and in what places. But in this case, it seems it was much more political calculus than about what they wanted to say. There have been plenty of BDS leaders who have been able to go into Israel and make comments about it.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks, as always, to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Kimberly Adams. She's the Washington correspondent for Marketplace, and Bor Deng. She's the Washington correspondent for The Times of London. This program was produced by Kim Lewis and Carol Castiel, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks so much for listening.